Thanks a lot. Yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, we wanted to use this opportunity to tell you like about a direction we're trying to move in my lab and taking some of these ideas that we've developed, these models in vision, models of efficient coding, and seeing how they might apply in the auditory domain. And so it's a relatively new field to me. I'm kind of a neophyte in this area, so I appreciate your feedback and pointers to things as we go. And the student who's been working with me in this is Sharik Mobin here. And this is not my lab. This is the Redwood Center, which is kind of a collection of several different labs at Berkeley and associated postdocs and students. And all the folks in the Redwood Center have backgrounds in math and engineering and physics. And we're basically bringing ideas from these fields to bear on problems in neuroscience. And also another connection to this group is through Chris. So Chris is why I'm here. So Chris was a postdoc in my lab almost 10 years ago, and this is a picture from back then. All right. That's right.
Just this picture is supposed to test if
oh, yeah.
Vision algorithms can identify people on the reflection center.
Oh, you're right. Down here, right. That's the truth. Yeah. Actually, one of our things, pictures, we turned this upside down. And that's a pretty good reflection. Okay, so let's see. So what this talk is really about is the search for principles that we could use to guide our thinking about what neural circuits are doing. And so it's useful to turn to another place in biology where the principles are actually known, and they tell us something, and that's in the design of eyes. And this is a really wonderful illustration from Michael Land's paper with Russell Fernald on the evolution of eyes. Michael Land has some other really beautiful works on this, especially the book that he co-authored together with Dan Nielsen on animal eyes. I don't know if there's a book called Animal Ears, but this book that Land wrote on animal eyes, just looking at the design of different eyes across the animal kingdom, was extremely important, influential to me. And I mean, before reading this book, I thought I understood vision. And in the process of reading the book, I realized I didn't know hardly anything about vision. And so it just sort of forces you to look at it in a very different way. And so,
an excellent suggestion, by the way. Yeah, if there's an ear version of
the Ivan Nielsen
book, that would be very
good. Yeah, I don't know.
It's just
you learn so many things from looking at it that way. And so one of the really neat things about this diagram, when you look at all these different eye designs you find throughout the animal kingdom, going from like a pit eye here, a pit eye has no lens in it. It's just simply a sort of a cup in the epithelium that makes a very crude image. To like a pinhole camera eye, to eyes that use refracting material to form an image. Some eyes use spherical mirrors at the back of the eye to refract the light. They actually use the mirror to do that. Some eyes have multiple lenses, movable lens systems, spherical lenses of fish here, and this is our eye here. And for example, the spherical lens of the fish has evolved independently 7 different times. So that's to say nature came up with the same solution for how to design a spherical lens independently. And to design a spherical lens, there's a certain formula you have to obey for how the index of refraction changes as you move from the center to the perimeter of the lens to make it optimal. So nature discovered that optimal design 7 different times, how to make a spherical lens. And so the remarkable thing about, you know, when you sort of look at all these different eye designs is that if you know the principles of optics, you can understand what's happening here. And that allows you to study all these different animals and make a story of how these eye designs help them for their particular behavioral niche that they live in. If you didn't know optics, you'd just be hosed. You'd just be looking at all this and you'd say, wow, you know, biology is diverse and so many different things, and I guess you can do it lots of different ways. But if you know optics, you sort of understand, well, there's only so many ways you can design an eye. You have certain constraints that you have to work around, what biology gives you, the materials you have to work with, but the laws of optics are just sort of there as universal laws, and those have to be obeyed if you want the system to work. And similarly, I think you can make the same argument for ears, of course, right? And one could probably come up with a similar diagram. and sort of understand those principles of acoustics and how ears have been designed and so forth. Okay, so that I think that's really neat that we can look at eyes that way. But then now the question is, when we go into the brain, you know, what are the principles that help us there, right? And the problem is that whereas with optics, you know, we can just open a textbook that was written 200 years ago and they're all written down there. There's no book that tells us what these principles are yet. And so we're in this interesting position in neuroscience and computational neuroscience where we're trying to sort of develop these principles at the same time as understanding how the nervous system implements them, right? And so this draws a lot on engineering and math and stuff like that, but not everything about that has been written yet, right? So we have to sort of write the book as well on that. And so I'm going to wager that there's at least two things, there's many others than these, but at least two things that I'm going to wager that are going to turn out to be just as important as optics for understanding nervous systems. And one is this idea of a principle of efficient coding, which was due to Horace Barlow. And the other idea of thinking about perception as an inference problem and the computations you have to do to perform inference, which is originally due to Helmholtz. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about here, is how these ideas have been applied in the visual system and how they've sort of helped us understand what's happening there and how we might use them to an audition as well. Okay, so this idea of efficient coding, as I mentioned, it goes back to Horace Barlow and even before him, Fred Atmayev. And this was coming shortly on the tail of information theory. You know, Shannon's information theory came out in the late 1940s. And so, you know, like 10 years later, the neuroscientists were looking at this and already trying to understand how this could be applied to help us understand the nervous system. These are purely theoretical papers. I mean, Horace Barlow, as you know, was an avid experimentalist, but he was a very strong theorist as well. This paper is more than 50 years old now. And so he proposed this idea, what he termed redundancy reduction, that nervous systems should try to reduce the redundancy in sensory signals. Okay, but the general idea of this hypothesis, that I think the way you can look about it, is that nervous systems should try to exploit statistical dependencies in the signals coming at them. Okay, so you sense all these signals from the environment, whether it be in vision, audition, in touch, or whatever, and in these signals are intrinsic statistical dependencies. And the nervous system needs to understand what these statistical dependencies are so that it can take the information, code it efficiently, and represent the data in a meaningful way. Okay, so that's the basic hypothesis. So one simple example of this idea, a really neat paper by Norman Redlich that came out in Neural Computation in the early 90s. So Norman Redlich read Horace Barlow's paper and said, okay, great, you know, why is this useful? Why might it help us? So it's just let's construct a simple example of why redundancy reduction would be a useful thing for a nervous system to do. I mean, Barlow sort of outlines the arguments in his paper, but doesn't really give a specific example. Okay, so here's a simple example where you simply take this text, and this is just all the text from Alice in Wonderland, and you omit the spaces in the text. So you have a stream of letters that are not differentiated according to what word they belong to. It's just a stream of characters coming into you. Okay, so just sort of think about this as a stream of data coming into a nervous system. It's just being bombarded with a sequence of characters, okay, 26 different characters. Okay, so this is just, Alice was beginning. You can just the text to Alice in Wonderland. It's just the beginning of the story. Okay, so now if you were being bombarded with this text stream of characters, what you would quickly notice is that there are certain patterns that seem to repeat here. Okay, certain sequences are more probable than others. So for example, things like T and H occur together more probable than chance, or Q and E, Q and U, and so forth. And so if you followed Horace Barlow's theory, then you say, okay, well, let's take this data and let's recode it into a new format where the new symbols are more statistically independent of each other, where the redundancies have been removed. So this is a highly redundant stream because it's redundant because you could predict, if I tell you what's here, you know, what characters in a different location, you could make a pretty good prediction of what's going to happen next. Not perfect, but you would know something, okay, based on the statistics. Okay, so it's a very redundant stream. So we're going to try to reformat into a new format that removes the statistical dependencies. And if you do that just based on pairwise correlation, so you say I'm going to recode it into a new symbol set, so the new symbols are more statistically independent of each other, just in terms of pairwise, you know, pairwise, adjacent pairwise statistics, then this is what the algorithm learns. So Redlich just applied a simple sort of like combinatoric algorithm. It tries different combinations of letters and came up with a solution. And this is less redundant than the original string. So it just took these five letters and combined them in the symbol Alice. Okay, so it says that's useful to make that a single unit, a single symbol, W-A-S, I-N-G, and things like that, right? T-H is combined together as a single symbol. Okay, so this is now taking that same text and just reparsing it according to the new symbol set that's been discovered purely based on statistics. Okay, just by minimizing pairwise.
Are the statistics just from that snippet of text?
No. From the whole corpus. Yeah, that's right. And this is just an example from the beginning. That's pairwise, and so now you could go further. You could say, well, let's minimize the three-way dependencies. You know, sequences of three or sequences of four, right? And if you keep on going, I think this was to fourth-order dependencies, then now you basically learn to these words that are occurring in the words or phrases that are occurring in the text. Okay, so it's learned to do this. It's learned about these words in the text purely from the statistics. Okay, no one told it what it had to do. No one gave it a goal and said, I need you to understand the story or something like that. Just purely based bottom up on the statistics, it learned a good representation of the data, which arguably now if you had to do sort of understanding of this that are related to things going on in the world, you'd be in a better position working with this symbol set than the letters. Okay, so you sort of help yourself. And so that's kind of a simple example. So, when I saw this, I was like, oh, wow, that's really fantastic. We just want to do that for images. Let's take image data and we'll do the same thing. And what do we get? Let's take sound data, the same thing. What do we get? Right? And that maybe this would sort of give us a useful feature set to look for in the system, where instead of Alice in Wonderland, it's going to be natural signals coming in. So signals that the world actually gives us. Right? So if we do that for images, then we have to sort of ask, well, then what do we know about the statistics of images? So for images, one thing we know is that we know a lot about their pairwise correlations. And one way we can characterize their pairwise correlations is in terms of the power spectrum, right? Because the power spectrum is just the Fourier transform of the autocorrelation function. And so this is something David Field did in 1987. And it turns out this was actually known long before he published this paper in the television industry. It was just kind of lore. People kind of just knew that images had 1/f² power spectrum. It's just nobody bothered to write about it. So David Field was the first to do that. And so if you this is just showing the power spectrum for six different images. Amplitudes. Amplitudes being the square root of the power on a log-log scale. And so this very remarkable thing comes out is that it's a sort of a universal property you see across all natural scenes is that they have a 1/f² power spectrum or 1/f amplitude spectrum. Okay, so it's actually hard. I'd give this as an exercise to students in my class just to take images off the internet and do this. It's hard to find an image that doesn't obey this property. Okay, you have to sort of find Venetian blinds or something with very regular structure. So why this is so? So this is sort of one aspect of structure that's in the natural world. It's one aspect of structure that's sitting there in the retina, in raw retinal signals that are coming in. So why this is so is an interesting question of itself. It's basically a sign of, so the fact that it's 1/f² means it has fractal structure, that you have scale invariance, means we have equal amounts of structure at all scales, okay? So it sort of says something interesting about the natural world, about the structure of things out there. But from a statistical point of view, we can sort of take that as a starting point and say, well, what should we do about that, right? If you were an engineer and designing a camera, and someone told you that every image coming into it is going to have this kind of power spectral signature, how would you want to design the front end to do that? So what Joe Adick and Norman Redlich proposed together was this idea of whitening, the whitening theory. They were at Rockefeller, a number of people here, Rockefeller. They were working at Rockefeller in the early 90s. And Joe Adick came from the field of string theory into computational neuroscience and did some really neat work around then. And so so what he did is he said, well, let's, according to Horace Barlow's redundancy reduction idea, we want to remove these dependencies. So so if the spectrum of things coming in is 1/f², then we want the signal going down the optic nerve to be white. Its power spectrum should be flat, right? Meaning that it's removed all these pairwise correlations. It just look random, okay? So we want the power spectrum of signals going down the optic nerve to basically just be flat as a function of frequency. So what comes in is 1/f and in amplitude. And so the ideal filter you would use to remove those dependencies is just a filter, this ideal filter A, which rises linearly with frequency, right? So if you just, in the frequency domain, had designed a filter whose gain rises linearly with frequency, that would basically cancel out this 1 over f characteristic and would give you something that's flat. Okay, and then you have to add an additional component, which is if you keep on doing this, essentially you're going to start just amplifying noise out here. So you want to have a low-pass filter that whose falloff is right around where you think the noise is getting greater than the signal. And that combination would be kind of like the ideal. This curve C would be like the ideal retinal filter you'd want to use. So if you sort of work out that idea, this processing looks very similar to what you see happen in the retina, these sort of center surround receptive fields. It turns out they have a very similar kind of whitening property. And this is what it looks like to take a natural scene and put it through that process. It's basically doing something like edge enhancement. Okay, and this image now has many fewer correlations. It's basically a redundancy-reduced version of the raw data coming in. So the argument is this is what you would want to send down the optic nerve, not that, because this would be a waste of neural resources. And interestingly, this idea has never been tested quantitatively in the spatial domain. Because what you would need to do, I mean, E.J. Chinchulinski could test it, but hasn't. But you'd need to sort of record from an array of neurons in response to natural scenes and so show that they're getting more decorrelated. But people have tested this in a time domain. So Yang Don did this together with Clay Reed and Joe Attic, also at the Rockefeller. So they just recording from a neuron in LGN, just looking at the temporal correlations. Okay, and what they did is then used a natural movie as input instead of a static image, a natural movie. In this case, Yang Don's choice of natural movie was the movie Casablanca, because it was fun to watch in the lab. So you just show Casablanca and you record from an LGN neuron. And what you'll notice is in that case also, the raw data coming in is also roughly 1 over f, okay, just in time. So if you just look at a single pixel in an image, its power spectrum is kind of fluctuating as 1 over f. So it also has temporal correlations, has these temporal correlations. And so you can say, okay, well then, if the retina is doing its job, according to Horst Barlow, then it should be removing those correlations. And the autocorrelation function you measure in the LGN neuron should be basically a delta function. And that's what you see. This is just showing the autocorrelation, the temporal autocorrelation function of three different cells in the LGN. And is doing a pretty good job removing these correlations, just giving the delta function. And this is showing the corresponding power spectrum, the temporal power spectrum of these neurons in the LGN in response to Casablanca. Okay, so this is very important because this theory of redundancy reduction, it doesn't say that you're going to remove the redundancy from just anything. It's been adapted to a certain kind of statistics. Okay, it removes natural scene statistics correlations. Okay, so that means that if you put in a different kind of ensemble with different statistics, it won't do this, right? So for example, if you put in white noise starts out random, and now if the system applies its whitening filter to it, well, it's basically going to color it according to its whitening filter, right?
It supports the hypothesis.
Yeah, exactly. Right, this is exactly what you would expect it to do, right? So great, so it's a beautiful test of this theory, right? As you have this, sort of very lofty sort of theory proposed, you can sort of work it out quantitatively with statistics, and this all seems to be working beautifully.
Can I ask a general question that you may be able to answer later in the talk? So the classic papers on efficient coding, did it talk much about the computations that could be performed, or it was just about efficient representation of the stimuli? You kind of mentioned briefly of the supervised learning, but
you have to do a computation to do this. Right.
Yeah, but I'm thinking in the context of what the problem the animal wants to solve.
What's the goal? Yeah, what's the goal of the organism? All that. No. So
did they talk about that much? Or?
No.
Okay.
So one of David Field's papers, the title is "What is the goal of sensory coding?" Yeah. Right. And so the idea here is, I mean, it's kind of a debatable hypothesis. It's can you assign a goal to sensory coding? Early sensory coding, independent of the behavior of the animal, because you say, well, depends on what the animal's trying to do, right? But that's a really hard thing to work backwards from. You say, well, what's the goal of a macaque monkey?
Yes.
Well, okay. I mean, you can't. So the idea is to try to sort of take that loftier goal and break it down into subcomponents. And now, can we just take maybe the front end of that system and say, okay, well, the monkey, the primate, has to do lots of things with its visual system. Let's just sort of go with this idea. It's just trying to get a sort of generic representation in the beginning. Okay, at later goals, we can't say that. It's going to be more specific. But in the beginning, it's just trying to get a generic representation that it can do lots of things with. and it's going to try to do that efficiently. And so maybe we can sort of think about the goal, that goal just being a kind of statistical reformatting question, and basically separate that from the, you know, the, all these sort of behavioral other questions. So eventually we have to confront those.
Without going to like the final goal of a monkey, for example, one could think of a linear separability of common features of the world or something along those lines.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. You could take it that way. That's right. I mean, I think that's another way, a nice extension of it. That's right. And in a sense, the question is to sort of ask, how far can you go with this approach? Okay, eventually you have to get in sort of tasks and things the animal has to do, but how far you can go in terms of these sort of general principles of separating out or factorizing different variables and things like that. Yeah.
Sorry, it's just semantics motivated it. So I could see how this could work well for kind of maybe a grayscale image or a grayscale way of thinking.
Yes.
And I see what you're saying about color noise, and I realize this is a bit of a tangent, but it seems like this would all get much messier with color vision.
There's a very nice story you can write down about color that was done by Dan Rudimer, and you can put color into this whole story, and it works out beautifully as well. It predicts all the LGN color opponent properties. That all kind of jives as well. Yeah.
What happens if the task is if one wants to discriminate between similar features in the space? And isn't that, I could imagine that it would be more difficult. Isn't it more difficult to do the task if you whiten everything out?
All this whitening is so far it's just a linear transform. You have, you know, warped the space in a way, but it's just a linear warping. You know, you did a rotation and you did a scaling. So you did stretch things in a way. So things that were close together before, you made them further apart. But maybe other things you pushed for closer together, right? The argument's going to be you're better off. Okay? So trust me for now. But yeah, I agree. It's not a sort of foregone conclusion, because you've done this change, and now maybe you made your job harder downstream, right? Okay? But the Redlich example of the Alice in Wonderland text, sort of the motivating example in the other direction. So like, look, just go with this and cross your finger, you know, might do something useful good for you.
So trying to connect it to convolutional neural nets that are obviously now popular for image processing, right? So I think they take advantage of that quote hierarchical structure or fractal structure, right, by extracting information at small length scales and then increasingly larger length scales, but pooling the stuff together. If you were to feed such a vibrant image to them, would they get problems?
Actually it would work better. It's a great question. So I actually want to try this. Because one of the things that helps the training of those deep nets is something called batch norm. And what they do in batch norm is they take the, within any given layer, you might notice the response to a whole bunch of images that some units are responding more than others. That's going to be bad for learning, because you're going to get big gradients on these guys and small gradients on these guys, right? So you kind of want to equalize the variance in this space, and you're kind of sphering it, and that makes the gradients work better for you. And so that's just sphering coordinate-wise. Yeah. What you really want to do is sphere generally in the whole space, and that's what whitening is doing, right? So I would argue this is definitely what it would probably help. But if batch norm helps you, and then following that exact same idea, then this is what you should do, actually. Because what's coming into the system, maybe we could just draw a picture here. If you think about, two pixels in an image, just as pixel one and pixel two, right? What we're saying is that these very strong correlations, and so the data distribution is highly anisotropic, like this. Imagine like if you have a little 10 by 10 image patch, there's 100 pixels there. So this is really like a 100 dimensional state space. And so the idea is in this 100 dimensional state space of like a 10 by 10 image patch, that space is just hugely not filled, right? So it just even within a two-dimensional space like this, there's hardly any data here. All the data lies in this tiny ellipse, okay? And so so if that's the case, then this is not going to be well behaved for doing gradient descent on during learning. You want to kind of stretch the sphere it and sort of get the data stretched out like this. That's decorrelation. That's what whitening is doing. That's all that whitening is doing.
And all the information at the different length scales is still there, right? Like in the picture you showed, yes. The contrast, so to speak.
Yes.
Just doing this
normalization. Yes. That's right. I mean, we've done hardly anything here, right? Because there's tons of structure left, right? All we did is remove the pairwise correlations. There's still all these higher order correlations. And those are the edges and contours and blah 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 blah. Yeah. Which is so we could think about that too, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But this is just like starting with a baby step. Just taking pairwise correlations and removing them. Okay, so this is a great idea. But it can only take you so far, because everything we've been talking about is kind of about compression. It's really about making more efficient use of the optic nerve. And if you want to sort of go on and think about what's happening in the cortex, some of the same elements of the story are going to apply and some not. And so Barlow wrote this other paper in 2000, 40 years after his redundancy reduction paper, kind of, you know, questioning something. It's like, you know, he's basically saying, you know, I wasn't really right about it. Not everything I said back in 1961 was totally on the ball, right? So he's saying this paper right now, 2000, argues that the original hypothesis was wrong in overemphasizing the role of compressive encoding and economy in numbers. Okay, so this idea of redundancy reduction, you just want to squeeze all the redundancy out. Okay, but it was right in drawing attention to the importance of redundancy. Right, so the idea is that you want to know about the redundancy, the statistical dependencies, but really what you want to do is you want to model them. Okay, you want to model the dependencies. Okay, one way to model dependencies is by removing them. If you can remove them, that's sort of proof that you know about them and you know what they are. But that's not the only way. And that's not necessarily the best way. And this maybe goes back to kind of your question, other people are asking, right? It depends on what you want to do down the road. So we want to know about them. We want to be able to represent them in different ways, but we don't necessarily want to remove them. Removing them is a good thing for compression. And compression is probably a good thing to do for the optic nerve. And maybe what I want to ask you guys is maybe for the auditory nerve, right? Maybe is that compression, right? Is that like a bottleneck? So if we want to squeeze information through a bottleneck, then redundancy reduction is a great thing to do. But in the cortex, we don't have a bottleneck, right? So here's the cortex, and this is also Barlow. Okay, so Barlow should win the Nobel Prize, right? Just so everyone's clear about that, right? In neuroscience, no question. He should have won it 20 years ago, because he's not only he did all this phenomenal, you know, foundational experimental work, discovering directional selectivity, characterizing photoreceptors, blah, 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 you name it. But he was like, his theories were just spot on, right? He was just like the most original, like adept and, you know, deep thinker of that time, and way, way, way ahead of the curve. So this is just a picture he made of a Nissl stain, a cross-section of V1, and this is layer 4C here. So this is layer 4C, with the input layer of the LGN. So this is where the LGN fibers come in and innervate. And what's being shown here to scale, so each one of these circles is a neuron in layer 4C in the input layer of V1. And what this is showing to scale is the spacing of the LGN afferents coming in, the parvocellular afferents coming in into V1, which are carrying like the detailed image information. Okay? So in this same picture would be repeated coming out of the board, right? So think about a square chunk of cortex and, you know, an array of neurons like this that are spaced this way and spaced the same way coming out of the board. So this is your input nodes. These are the input sort of fibers, you know, your pixels coming into cortex. And here's like the first layer of your neural network. This is definitely not a bottleneck, right? This is doing dimensionality expansion, right? It's taking sort of a small number of signals and throwing it into high dimensional space. Okay, so I think this is a really neat example of where the anatomy is telling us something very important. And that it likes this idea of high dimensionality over representing the data. Okay, so compression is not the right way of thinking about it, or, you know, removing redundancy necessarily, right? And so so the way sort of Barlow thinks about this, or and proposed, and so we think about it now, is what it's trying to do is throw this into a higher dimensional space and also be more sparse. Okay, so it's trying to sparsify the activity. So if you looked at this population of neurons, if you could sort of look at a whole population of them, only a small fraction of them would be active at any given time. Okay? So that's basically the idea of sparse coding, and Chris talked about sparse coding, but I kind of want to approach it in a different way here and motivate it in terms of this idea of sort of like a bottleneck in terms of this framework and something in neural networks called an autoencoder network. An autoencoder network is just a simple neural network that has an input layer, a hidden layer, and an output layer. And the goal of an autoencoder is to make the output reconstruct the input. Okay, so the output is just simply exactly try to get back what you put in. Okay, so this could be sound, this could be images, it could be whatever. Okay, so this is the goal of the autoencoder, is just minimize the squared error between this signal and this signal. And of course, what makes this interesting is you're going to sort of take this information, you're going to squeeze it through a bottleneck. Okay, so it wouldn't be interesting if you just had as many units here and they could do anything, then it wouldn't be an interesting question. Of course, you can get it back. You can make an invertible transform. But it becomes interesting when you make this a bottleneck, when you make it fewer units, and now you train the system, find me a weight matrix, which takes this information and squeezes it into here so I can get the most amount of information back. We may not be able to get all of it back, but get as much back as possible. Okay, so when you consider the case where this matrix M is just the transpose of this matrix, it turns out that this is PCA. This is what PCA is doing. Okay, so it's just trying to find a linear subspace that captures the most amount of variance in the data. And that's, PCA is not a very good way of thinking about what the retina is doing, because in PCA you sort of have this rank ordering. You have one unit that carries like ginormous amount of variance, the next unit carries less, the next unit less. And we don't really see that in neurons, right? It's not like you have one big whopping neuron which carries everything and then right sort of goes down. Like they're all sort of seem to be quite homogeneous and evenly carrying the load. So the idea is that you have a different kind of bottleneck in the retina, which is that you have these limited capacity units. Okay, so you might have many units still, or maybe as many as you have here. So in the retina, for example, there are two, in the fovea, every cone has two midget retinal ganglion cells reporting that cone's value to the LGM. Okay, so there's two wires coming out of the optic nerve for every cone within the fovea. Okay, so it's not, it's a modest bottleneck, if anything. It is a bottleneck, but the way the bottleneck comes in is not by in terms of numbers of neurons, but it comes in the fact that those neurons are spiking neurons, right? They don't carry graded analog activities. They're spiking neurons, okay? So they're sort of now limited in their coding capacity, how much information they can carry. And they're also presumably noisy, okay? They have some noise in them. So you basically have these units here which have limited carrying capacity. And in that case, the optimal thing to do is whiten, this thing we talked about that Adek proposed, okay? Something close to whitening is the optimal thing to do. What it does basically is it tries to decorrelate, sphere the space like this, so that now you can evenly carry the load and you have neurons in different directions that are sort of evenly sort of subdivide all the variants. Okay, so now another kind of bottleneck is this idea of sparse coding. Okay, so in sparse coding, we might have a hidden layer here with a huge numbers of neurons, right, with way more neurons than we have down here. But the way we're going to impose a bottleneck is by forcing only allowing a small fraction of them to be active in a given time. Okay, so which neurons are active will change from one time to the next, depending on what we put in here. We're going to only force a small number to be active. So that's what makes it interesting. And that's what's going to force it to learn something about the structure down here.
So that would then be more model for the cortex instead of the LGM, right, due to sparse coding but large number of neurons?
We say that.
Would that then rather be a model for the cortex instead of the LGM due to that large number of neurons and that sparse coding?
That's right. This is more like the layer four. You think of this as like LGM coming in,
yeah,
and this is layer four. This is more the model you want to fit in there.
Before the whitening approach, that would be.
That'd be retina.
In the periphery.
That's the theory. That's what the retina is trying to do. The retina is trying to squeeze.
And potentially of the cochlea as well.
Exactly. There we go. Right. So the question is how can we take these ideas, or should we take these ideas? Maybe it does. Maybe it's not appropriate. But how do we take these ideas and map them onto the auditory pathway? So I just want to say another word about sparse coding. Like why? Okay. So why would you want to do this? Why is this a good thing, right? And the argument is it's a good thing for representational reasons. It's not trying to squeeze things, but the animal needs to behave. It needs to do some task. It needs to learn associations, patterns, and stuff like that going on in the world. And this is a useful strategy for helping an animal learn patterns, learn about structure in the world. Yeah?
These models that you have been creating, could you discuss a bit why would it be relevant to reconstruct?
Yeah. So this goes back to, the ultimate goal of the organism thing, right? And so we don't know, right? It might be that you're willing to discard some pieces of information and you don't care about getting everything back, okay? But again, sort of like the assumption we're going to make up front here, it may not be true, but we're just going to put it forth here, is to say, initially, in the early visual pathway, I don't know what information I want to drop and what's relevant or not yet. I just want to keep everything. Okay, so let's just go with the idea of I want to keep everything and I want to do as efficiently as possible. Okay, so this is just a proxy for keep everything, or high mutual information. It may be wrong, if it's wrong, we can go back and fix it. Okay? But I think, you know, for something like a primate, you know, going into Elgin and V1, it's not like, you know, you're going to say, oh yeah, pixel number 236, I don't need that pixel. You know, you need all of them, right? And because the decisions about what information you want to drop and what you want to keep, that really can't be made until you get to a sufficiently high level. Once you sort of code things to the level of faces and object shape, well, we can say, okay, faces, those are really important. I want to sort of expand that space, and these other objects I don't care so much about. But that's at a very advanced level of coding. It's not down at this pixel level.
But can you say more about, the retina processing? So wait, I guess there's also bottleneck at that level. So what is the challenge there?
This would be the retinal bottleneck. This would be like the cones.
Yes.
And this would be like your retinal ganglion cells that have limited coding capacity as compared to a cone, because a cone has all these graded levels it can take on, right, and fluctuations along a continuum, right? And then now the retinal ganglion cell is forced to get that information out of the optic nerve by discrete spikes. Or this might be hair cells, and these would be auditory nerve fibers, which can only spike, right? It's binary code. And you have to get this, you know, you want to get this analog fluctuations out just by spikes, right? That's a limited coding capacity.
Right.
I mean, according to, like, Bill of Alex estimates, you know, you get like two to three bits per spike.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not very much. So.
Yes. And how do you get it back via individual?
Okay, so it's a good question. I don't know, but so like for spiking neuron models, like if you again in the Bialik framework, he goes with this idea of like linear encoding and nonlinear encoding, linear decoding. So with a spiking neuron, right, so that's a nonlinear encoder, right, because you're making a sort of very hard threshold kind of thing. So you have a nonlinear encoder, and they do simply linear decoding, right, for like the fly H1 neuron. They simply take a linear filter and combine it with the spikes, and that does really well at getting the information out. So in some cases, it could just be a linear, very simple decoder here. But in general, that's, you know, I think it's, yeah, it's an important question to answer. But right now, it's really just about, you know, the idea is that we know we have a bottleneck there, information-wise. We have a bottleneck in terms of these spiking neurons.
But if you have spiking nets and they, like, synchronize or phase lock,
yes,
maybe too limited to say that they carry one bit?
Ah, well, okay. So you can try that model, right? I mean, so that might be true. I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's a really cool idea. So Fritz Sommer is one of my colleagues at the Webber Center. He's working on these models of how when neurons synchronize, you can sort of have more information about global properties encoded in the phase, the phase of spike, the relative timing of, you know, of spiking. So I think that's a really cool idea. But again, you know, like one step at a time. You know, so I said, yeah. Okay. All right. So why sparse? Why do you want to do that? Right? Why would you want to make things sparse? So let's just talk about that a little bit. And motivate that. So Horace Barlow talks about this in his paper, his other paper, 1972 paper, that's where he proposed this idea of sparse coding. And so one way to think about a sparse distributed code, is sort of, it's like one point on a continuum between dense codes at one end and what we might think of as grandmother cells codes, like the ultimate sparsity at the other end, right? So this is the easiest. I mean, this is the ultimate sparse code. Is where you have one neuron for each and everything in the world, right? And that neuron codes your grandmother, and that neuron codes your dog, and so forth, right? And so this is almost like an idea we talk about in neuroscience, but nobody believes in. But it's nevertheless useful to have there on the landscape of ideas to talk about. Okay, so if you had this kind of system, this would actually be great. This would be an easy system to work with because it's very easy to read out, right? If you want to know if grandma is there, you just look at that neuron. Right, it's an easy decision. Okay, so if you want to form associations and motor, you know, control actions and so forth, this is the advantage of this kind of code is it makes information explicit. That's good. The downside is that it has very low coding capacity. Okay, so if we have n neurons, we can only code n things. Okay, and it's also going to be very brittle. Right, if we lose a neuron, we lose that thing. This kind of code over here. Has very high coding capacity, so if we have n neurons and they're binary, then we could code 2 to the n things. Okay, so it has a large representational capacity for representing different things, but it doesn't not make information explicit. So one example would be like an ASCII code, right? The ASCII code has 8 bits for representing each character, and if you want to know what character has been pressed, you have to look at all 8 bits, right? You can't just look at one neuron. Okay, so your wiring problem of sort of learning association is much more complicated in this space. trying to linearly separate patterns and so forth, you have problems here. Okay, so the idea here is to sort of have a happy medium between these two extremes. So by expanding the dimensionality, making the activity sparse, you still have very high coding capacity. So if you had, for example, think about it, a population of n neurons, and I'm only going to allow k of them to be active, then the coding capacity would be n choose k. Okay, so there's n choose k possible patterns I could make here, right? So think about just like a population of, if this were even like 1,000 neurons and k is 10, 1,000 choose 10 is ginormous. Okay, so you have very high coding capacity here still, but you also have, now you're sort of beginning to make information more explicit. Okay, so you have sort of the idea of grandmother cells here going on as well. Okay, so that's kind of an intuitive idea of why you might want to do this for representational reasons, and it helps you learn associations at higher stages.
Has anybody ever tried to estimate like how much information we store as humans? Because we definitely have a huge number of neurons, right? So I'm just trying to figure out, like, it's great to see it this way, right? Like,
so do you mean
do we store more information than we have neurons available, or how do these things compare? I mean, it's obviously very difficult to estimate, right? But I don't know if anybody has estimated that.
I mean, you even have, like, when we do language modeling, you're covering all these levels in a way, because you have the dense code for representing the words, you just enumerate them, and you represent them with the local code, and then you do a corresponding embedding, which gives you sparse code of that, which is the linear transformation from the local code into a sparse code.
You could just run from here to here, you mean?
Yeah. So that's why how technically your networks for language modeling.
Oh, I see. The way they, so like they start with a one hot vector for words, and then they code it into this kind of space. Yeah, right. So in terms of like memory capacity, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, one thing I can tell you is there are these experiments of Standing, which are very interesting from the 1970s, and where they asked how many scenes can you remember. Okay. So the way psychologists who study memory oftentimes use word lists, and your capacity for words is like 30. Right. Once I show you 30 words in a study list, and then I ask you, okay, was this word on your list? Your performance goes to pot. Like 30 words is about as many as you can reliably get. Okay. For images, if I use scenes, like photographs of scenes, okay, and I give you a study list of scenes, and I throw these at you, like one per second, this scene. How many do you think it is? Take a while.
Obviously, a lot more than 30, so maybe 10,000.
10,000, yeah, that's right. That's right. So Standing, with us, Standing showed. And think about doing that experiment. It took a week to do the experiment, right, to show a subject 10,000 images of the study list, right? So it's not even clear if the capacity has actually been fully characterized. So that, I think that's really profound, because what it sort of says is that certain kind of patterns, like words, they just don't sink into your memory. They just kind of bounce off, right? But scenes, they just sink in there, right? The system latches onto them and it says, okay. You know, they just go bam, 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 and it sticks.
So it sticks
in the system.
If you show me 10,000 images, and then you show me another one.
Okay. So Odaliva is getting, I'm sorry.
So what's the task exactly?
So the task, I'm sorry, I thought you were going to ask something else. Okay.
So
the task is simply, I'm going to show you 10,000 images, and now I'm going to show you just another random image. Okay. A week later, next week, I show you just a random image, and was this in the study list or not? Okay. So now the question might occur to you is like, well, you know, you get to a certain point is how many images can you come up with? Maybe if I show you like what someone's scene was like a boat scene, there's a harbor and some sailboats, and if I took that same scene, like, you know, remove the buoy in the background, well, obviously, you know, you're not going to remember. So Odaliva has actually been looking at that issue.
So
your capacity is very high, but at the same time, very paradoxically noisy. Yeah.
How about showing 10,000 handwritten words?
Aha. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, cool. Yeah, maybe something unique about the style that sticks.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now I think it's a really interesting question, but again I think this is important because it has to do with how the system is adapted to natural scene statistics. Right. For certain kinds of statistical structure, the system just latches onto it. Other kinds of statistical structure, it just bounces off the system.
Okay, I'm still a bit confused. So
okay.
You show me 10,000 images, and you show me another one. And I will be able to say whether it was within those 10,000.
Well, yeah, the question was this on the study list or not? And what's your performance on that? Are you guessing at this point, or are you 75% correct or more, right? And your wave of chance at answering that. So you can say, yes, this was on the steady list or not, way above chance, and you're correct.
Mm-hmm. But if you just place some subtlety as you were, but when it was not on it...
If you start playing tricks, it's going to fall apart. To do this fair, right? These are unique images, right? But the words are unique too. I mean, those are just words, right? So we're not playing tricks with the words either, right?
Is it easier to trick with images than with words?
Well, okay, it's a good question. Yeah. Really cool questions, yeah.
But people do this with voices so that they get like a small sentence and then from different people reading some things, and then you have to judge whether you heard that voice before. It's maybe more to a scene, right?
You're attaching something natural to it, yeah, that can be, yeah, maybe. And I think it's really interesting. So now I want to get to this question of like the sparse coding and these different results you get in the visual and auditory system. So we get to the cortical level here, and you apply this idea of sparse coding in the cortex. So you train a bunch of natural images, and you say, okay, fine, I'm going to buy Barlow's idea, his second idea, again, right, that the cortex is doing sparse coding, not redundancy reduction, but sparse coding. And so if I learn a sparse code based on the statistics of natural images, what do I get? And the answer is you get this. Okay, so you put in a bunch of natural scenes, and based on the statistics of images, it learns that a good way to sort of parcelate that space to make a sparse representation is to make these neurons selective to different positions, different orientations, and different scales. Okay, that's the way it sort of decides to divvy up the space. Okay, and so that agrees very nicely with what we see in V1. Okay, so that said, and then it gives you strong support. Okay, well, the story seems to fit, you know, that if V1 were trying to do sparse coding, it couldn't do much better than to use these kinds of receptive fields. Okay, so that part matches. Now you do this in auditory domain. This is what Smith and Lewicki did, and also Mike Lewicki before in another paper, where you start with taking an ensemble of natural sounds. They sort of took a different potpourri of environmental sounds and speech and animal vocalizations. Other animal vocalizations, I train sparse coding on that, and you get something that very well matches the auditory neural filters. Okay. So this is kind of weird, right? Because you apply, so you have this, we're trying to argue for like this universal principle, you know, you can understand things with, right? And so you apply this principle to in the visual system and it predicts V1, you apply it in the auditory system, it predicts the auditory nerve. So why is it, if you do this on images, why don't you get the retina here? Right? You're getting instead the auditory nerve. Okay? So what then the question is, well, what predicts the auditory cortex? I mean, you'd like to have like one theory that says like this is what cortex does with statistics of signals that come in. So I think this is I'm going to put this forth as a paradox, or something we'd like to try to resolve.
Can I ask again, how does the sparse coding relate again to the whitening that you presented initially?
We skipped all that, didn't we? Right? Okay. So in the images, what we did here in this work is we start with natural images, we whiten them first. I should have put that as a step. We whiten them, we say, okay, the retina whitens, and then I'm gonna learn my sparse coding, okay, and do this. But it turns out I don't have to do the whitening. I could just train on raw natural images and I'll still get the solution. You don't get center surround receptive fields. It ain't gonna happen if you do sparse coding. Okay?
And with the natural sounds, there was no whitening step.
No whitening step. Yeah, they just. That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay. And it would be an interesting question to think about. Well, what would it mean to whiten sound? You know,
it would be something. Didn't say that the sparse coding would apply later, so at the cortical level.
Yeah.
Well, this peripheral processing should be different. Should be like this. I thought that this whitening concept would be different from the sparse coding.
That's right. Concept. That's right. It is. They're two very different strategies. Yes. Whitening is not sparse coding. They're two different strategies. And so the proposal we'd like to make in the visual system is that, you know, the retina does whitening. I should have had it on here. The retina does whitening because it's a bottleneck. It's trying to compress. And the cortex does sparse coding because it's trying to expand in a meaningful space and do behavior, right? Okay. But this is just about delivering information. So we're going to map this idea on the auditory pathway. We say, okay, I expect one thing low level to do compression. Yeah. And then when I get up to cortex, now I expand and I do sparse coding. But now, you know, I do this, and I already get the auditory filters, you know, according to the story, already look like they're doing sparse coding. Huh. But, so it doesn't seem to fit, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead. I think you were first.
Not being a vision person, quote unquote, my understanding was that basically you find qualitatively similar receptive fields in retinal ganglion cells as well, which would be maybe close to the auditory nerve data. So it's not only V1 where you find these.
Also in V1 you find the center surround cells, right? Is that what you're saying?
Like he's saying the other way.
I'm trying to say that you find those even earlier.
Oh, oriented receptive fields.
In retinal ganglion cells, no?
Oh.
Don't you know? I thought you would.
I think there's some, are you talking about these very recent findings that people have?
It's more the question, if you find similar results as in the auditory system, that means you find also in the retina, already sparse coding.
Retinal receptive fields have all kinds of extent and of directional characteristics.
As far as I know, there's a directional selectivity.
Yes, I mean,
motion. That's in retinal neurons, that's correct. But in terms of oriented receptive fields, I mean, this would not be a standard textbook finding. I mean, no textbook is going to tell you that retinal neurons have oriented receptive fields, like spatially oriented. Like they're selective to the orientation of an edge, right? That would be a very avant-garde idea. I mean, there's some people who claim that there's some hint of that, but there's not at all kind of a standard. Yeah, so basically I think the standard textbook story for retina would be that the cells are non-orientation selective, right? It's like a sort of bandpass filtering.
Okay, and now the research findings. Maybe I have to go back and check with my colleagues, but I thought you would also have directional selectivity in the retina.
Not. This is just spatial. You might be talking about the motion directional selectivity.
Yeah, that could be.
There are neurons that are directional selective to different motions in the retina, yeah.
Bruno, in Mike's study, did he use animal vocalizations as well as environmental?
Yes. A mixture. So he did it different ways. You can train on like each of these ensembles one at a time, just on animal vocalization, just on this, or like a mixture of all three.
Yeah. And do the statistics of those animal vocalizations behave according to that power
gap? Okay, whether they're 1/F, okay, that's a good question. So Frederick Tunison has done some work on this, and I should have mentioned with the power law, the 1/F² type idea. People have seen that in the power spectrum of the amplitude envelope. This was the finding by Voss and Clark from a long time ago. So if you just take the amplitude envelope of natural sounds, many different natural sounds, then that tends to be 1/F. But whether you just do it on the raw waveform, my understanding is it's not really quite 1/F. And that would heavily depend on the ensemble you pick. If you pick animal this versus that, you're going to get probably different answers. It's not like this universal idea that I was talking about for images. Yeah. But if you sort of average them all out, if you just sort of say on average I have this sort of mixture and I want to sort of just have one monolithic filter for all of it, right, then maybe I don't know what the answer would be actually. Yeah.
Because they get the same result when training on human speech.
Okay, so no, so this result actually, very importantly, I should have had the figure from the paper, this changes depending on what you train on, okay? If you just train on animal vocalizations, you get something more like a short-time Fourier code, and you don't get constant Q filters, okay? So they basically, they look more like a traditional Gabor code, so it's just more like a Fourier, short-time Fourier code. If you train on environmental sounds, it scales very much like a wavelet with a constant Q. And if you look at speech, if you train just on speech, you end up something that's closer to wavelet than Fourier and kind of between. And if you train on mixture of all these, then you kind of get that in-between thing, yeah. It's sort of it's closer to a wavelet. It's fairly constant Q, I would say. And that's what I'm showing here. Yeah.
What do you think about the idea that anatomically A1 doesn't look like V1, it looks like IT or something. So computationally, we shouldn't be trying
yes.
analogous.
Right. That's because you mean because like in the auditory pathway you're going through more stages.
Not just that, but the structure of A1.
Aha.
Uh-huh. Like it has a shitty airport. No, important. It's great at what it is. I beg your pardon. Like good deal airport with no stellate
yes.
cells. The connections are made onto pyramids.
Yes.
All that sort of thing.
Oh. Okay. That's cool. That's really because I wanted to ask you guys this. I forgot to ask you that. I mean, does this you know if you looked at layer 4 of A1, does it look like this? Like if these are MGN cells, right? You're saying maybe not.
Therefore, it's very different in A1.
Yeah. A1. Oh, very cool. Okay. So.
Well, isn't layer 4 expanded in V1 in a way that's not? And isn't the thickness even just of layer 4?
Yeah, you know, it's got in the Fermi, it's got sublayers even.
Yeah.
It's super elaborate. It's not.
and that doesn't happen in A1.
Certainly not.
So who would I look at for that, like an anatomy paper on that? Do you know?
Your colleague. Weiner, Jeff Weiner.
Oh, Jeff Weiner. I see. Okay.
And Kim Yanoku made a similar point in a paper a couple of years ago. King and Nelson, they're also auditory guys.
Okay, well, all right. So, yeah.
Back to your auditory nerve thing.
Yeah.
Are those just impulse responses extracted from the data, or?
They are, what they're showing here, the red lines are the model-derived filter, and you could just measure that. It has, it's an impulse response, essentially, so the filter. And then the blue lines that are superimposed, that's data. That's an actual measured auditory filter with I don't know if it was an impulse response measure to white noise rev core. I don't know how they did it.
It was the white noise rev core.
The information there is essentially the center frequency and the Q, or the tuning width, for the individual frequencies of all these filters.
The central idea is there's a population here. I should have the other plot. I'm sorry, but the central idea is that the algorithm derives is not just one neuron, but neuron. It's a population, and they tile time frequency space like a wavelet, and like the auditory nerve does.
So if you have a bat's auditory cortex, individual neurons have an incredible range of selectivities, or sweep rates, for durations and intervals and all that sort of thing. But if you anesthetize the bat, each neuron's principal excitatory input looks an awful lot like an auditory nerve fiber. It just tunes a particular frequency and a particular width. And so what I'm thinking of is, the idea of the sparse coding, things are happening in the auditory system over time, and it's frequencies occurring at different times rather than just the center frequency of the filter that you might be looking for. That's all.
Okay.
So I'm sorry, a quick question. For the V1 receptors field, so just take one of them. So you have your little Gabor thing. You need to know, I guess, where the center is, what the frequency of it is, what the orientation. Is there also the phase of it in there? Is that like one of the things that's kind of hard-coded into a given unit's receptor?
That's sort of, that more is like an even phase, and this is an odd phase.
Okay.
So,
cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so if you look at how, so that's just showing you some sample. What I was showing you down there was just some sample filters that that sparse coding learns on sound. And this is how the sparse coding algorithm would actually code a sound waveform. So this is just showing an example. The gray here in the background is a sound waveform. And now this is the sparse representation of it. What each dot is showing you is a coefficient in that sparse code, its activity. Time is going this way, and each of those coefficients has a different basis function, which has a best frequency. There's a best frequency of that unit is being shown on this axis. Okay, so the point of here is it gives you this very sparse representation of the sound waveform, right? So the sound waveform is sort of undulating in very complex ways, and the nice thing that the sparse coding is doing for you is delivering you this very compact representation of all the sort of undulating structure in your waveform, right? Sort of compact summarization of, like, in terms of these atoms, these time frequency atoms, these gamma tone filters. So when one of these units fires, when a single unit like that fires, it means that whole kind of gamma tone thing was present there, and it's absorbed that whole event through this whole event here has been absorbed through the activity of that single element, and no one else needs to fire. Okay, so it produces this extremely sparse representation. So that seems kind of good. Right, and one thing they showed in this paper is that actually you can get very good compression out of this. So if you can code, you can get compressions better than MP3 out of this kind of sparse code. Okay, but the question is this what the auditory nerve does? I don't think so, right? Because this is, what the auditory nerve looks like in response to a vowel. This is the waveform burst and the vowel undulation is, and this is the spike histogram of individual auditory nerve fibers, just rank ordered in frequency here, right? I'm sure you guys are familiar with this plot, but this doesn't look like a sparse code. Right? So that's another kind of mismatch here, right? So you ask for a sparse code, you get something like auditory filters, which makes you looks like that part's true, but the auditory nerve is not coding things that sparsely, right? It doesn't seem to be doing that, right? So let's think about this and go back to this bottleneck idea. So I guess what I'm going to argue is we kind of got ahead of the game, right? We sort of jumped too quickly to the site. We just took raw auditory waveforms. We said, oh, let's do sparse coding on it. We get the answer, and we got the right answer, but maybe for the wrong reason. Okay, and so let's go back and think about what went into this, and think about this bottleneck idea, right? So you have this set of limited capacity units, right? And you have this sound waveform that comes in. It's a single. So in the auditory case, like this is a single number, right? It's like an array of things. It's a single number. The waveform, right, comes in, and you have to deliver that waveform to the brain with 30,000 or so fibers that have spiking neurons, right? And it's trying to do the highest fidelity job it can, trying to deliver this information to the brain, just with spikes. Okay, saying to you that taking this analog graded, very high dynamic range signal, and gets that to the brain. So that's a very challenging job, right? That's a very challenging thing to do. So you have to squeeze things through this bottleneck. So let's think about that problem of coding things through a bottleneck. And now it comes time to do a little fun brain teaser exercise about coding things through a bottleneck, right? So here's a problem that is in David McKay's beautiful book. This is an absolutely stunning book, by the way. So David McKay, who's like truly a genius, I think. He died very tragically about a year ago, and was one of my student colleagues at Caltech. And but he wrote this book. He wrote another book on energy, you know, production and stuff like that. And just really brilliant guy. But in this book, he a lot of it, so he talks partly about information theory and coding and how it's related to neural networks and Bayesian inference and all these other kinds of things. It's a really beautifully written book. So this is one of the exercises he gives in the book to think about coding. Okay, so here's the problem. You're given 12 balls, and one of the balls is heavier or lighter than the other. So all the balls are the same except for one. There's one standout. It's different weight. Okay? And you are given a two-pan balance to use, right? Just a balance scale, two-pan balance to use. In each use of the balance, you may put any number of the 12 balls in the left pan and the same number in the right pan, and push a button to initiate the weighing. Okay? There are three possible outcomes. Either the weights are equal, or the balls on the left are heavier, or the balls on the right are heavier, right? So the balance can do this, it can do this, or can do that, right? The balance can give you three answers. And so now your job is to figure out how should you place these balls in the scales so as to use this balance scale the fewest number of times. Okay, so each time you use the balance, I'm going to charge you for it. Okay, and you want to then be able to solve this problem, find the outlier with the fewest number of uses of the balance. Anybody figure out the answer? So I
just looked it up.
Oh. Wow, that's fast. You get extra credit for everything. Okay. I guess the first reaction I would have had is say, well, I'll take the 12 balls, divide them in two groups of six, and try that first, you know, and see which is heavier, right? And proceed from there. And you can eventually get the answer that way, but you're going to take many uses of the balance, okay, to do that. It's not the optimal answer. And the reason why is because if you put six on each, then the only way the balance can turn out is you'll get this or you'll get that. But it will never do that, right? And that's bad use of the balance because that was potential information you could have gained and you didn't get that, right? So the optimal answer is take groups of four. So you have three groups of four, and now take two of those four groups and put that on, right? And now you can get the middle outcome as equal probable solution. So each one of those will be equal probable, and you're going to get the most amount of information. Okay? That's information theory in a nutshell. That's coding theory in a nutshell, right? It's like playing 20 questions, right? When you play 20 questions, the first question you ask is like, is it bigger than a bread box? You wouldn't ask, is it bigger than Jupiter? Because that's, you know, a waste of a question, right? So the same thing here. What these auditory nerve fibers, what any neuron is doing, right, is sort of like asking a question. It's interrogating the signal and trying to deliver information to the brain. So the name of the game is you want to use all these outcomes equally often, right? So if a neuron could have taken on this value or this value, then you want to use all those values as equally often as possible. Or in the joint state space, right, think of this as neuron 1 and neuron 2, you want to fill the joint space, right? So if you were doing something like this, that would also be bad because it would look like neuron 1 is getting used equally often. It would look like neuron 2 is getting used equally often. But in the joint space, you have a hole, okay? There's no information being conveyed in here. You're wasting bandwidth, okay? So you want to fill the space. That's the name of the game in coding theory, is you want to fill the channel. That is not sparse coding, right? Sparse coding does not fill the channel, right? That's doing the exact opposite. In sparse coding, any neuron spends most of its time at zero, right? It's sitting there, so rarely does it become active. So that's not a very good channel coding strategy. Okay, so for compression, if we think about something like the optic nerve or the auditory nerve or any other sensory nerve as a bottleneck, then we could say that the goal is it's trying to format information in a way that's trying to fill the channel. So there is some really enlightening work that was done recently by Jan Karklin with Iro Simoncelli, where I think they basically nailed it now for the retina. So and helped resolve some of these paradoxes. So it's what they did for the retina is they said, well, let's start with an image. I'm going to have an array of neurons, each of which has a different filter, W, which I'm going to learn. I don't know what those are. I don't know what they should be. And I'm going to take these and put them through a nonlinearity, a pointwise nonlinearity, to give me a positive-only output. So that's one constraint, is that these are going to be something akin to firing rates of neurons. Okay, so it's positive-only. It can be zero or it can be higher than zero, but it can't just be like an arbitrary number, negative number, right? So these are constrained to be positive not only, and we're going to add noise. Okay, so there's going to be a noisy channel. We're going to take this image data and force it through a noisy channel. So each of these neurons is going to be bombarded with some noise, and they can't escape that noise because we're going to put a penalty on activity. So this is like a metabolic energy or metabolic usage constraint, right, for the neurons. We're going to say that we want to convey the image. So this is the goal, the objective function of the system. So you want to say, I want to convey the image data as faithfully as possible. I want to maximize mutual formation between the image here, X, and the output, R. These are my like retinal ganglion cells, output firing rates. I want to maximize that mutual formation, but subject to a constraint on firing, right? I want to do it with the minimal amount of energy, the minimal amount of spikes coming out. And these are noisy neurons that are also being bombarded by noise. Okay, so that's important to put this constraint on because for a fixed level of noise, the system could easily escape the noise by just having a really large firing rate, okay, by having a whopping signal. But that's going to cost you lots of energy to do that, right? So we don't want to let it escape by doing that. So you need to put this penalty on activity. Okay, so you put this penalty on activity together with the noise so it can't escape the noise. And now it's forced to come up with the best possible code for going through this limited capacity bottleneck. And what it learns really beautifully is a set of on and off center surround receptive fields. So these are showing the different filters. Each one of these is a different learned filter. And so now the sign of these filters actually means something because the neuron is positive only, right? Before, like in a lot of sparse coding stuff we show you, the neurons are positive or negative. So the sign of this function doesn't mean anything usually. Right? But here it really means something. It's important. Okay, so it learns, basically splits the population into these on and off cells. And what's also really neat is that they basically tile, just like sort of E.J. Chinchulinski shows. And so you could just take out these on-center cells, consider them as one population, and they just plot their centers and their radiuses. And this is what they look like. And this is what, just pull out the off cells from this population, and this is what they look like. Okay, so the algorithm learns on its own just to tile the space. It learns that the best strategy is to split it into two groups. And what's fascinating to me about this is the first thing that the retina does. The first synapse from the cones to the bipolar cell is this inverting synapse, right? One for, you know, the cone goes onto one on cell and one off cell, right? It has two different types of synapses for that. This is the very earliest transformation it does. So it's almost like though, the reason for doing that is to sort of format the signal for going through the optic nervous spikes. And also, what's also been noticed in the literature is that the off cells tend to be smaller and more numerous than the on cells. And this also comes out in the simulation. Okay, so there's...
What defines the length scale or the number of these filters?
So that's something preordained. He plugs in different numbers, but for this simulation, I'm pretty sure this is like a 16 by 16 image patch, and he has 100 neurons coding.
Okay.
So just and you can try different numbers, and in the paper he shows how it sort of pans out for different configurations. But this is what pans out. It's importantly in the noisy regime. Okay, when you have to code with noisy neurons. Okay, and then also interestingly, then when you are allowed to code with non-noisy neurons, okay, so if you give the retina neurons that have like 20 dB of signal to noise in them, this is the solution you get. And that's interesting because this objective function, going back two slides, this objective function, you know, if you just sort of came from sparse coding community and looked at this, a sparse coding person would say, yeah, that looks like sparse coding. This is like your sparsity cost function. Okay? You might call this sparse coding. And in fact, in the noiseless regime, it does something like that. Okay? But it turns out this is a really bad solution to code with a limited number of noisy neurons. So that's this in blue, because this is showing the mutual formation you get per spike rate. So you just try. He dials in that parameter lambda to allow different spike rates. And so the best solution, if you want to get the most amount of information through with noisy neurons, is you need to use these kinds of receptive fields, not these. Okay? If you have noiseless neurons, then you can do this. But with noisy population, this is PCA. And PCA is really bad also. Okay, so I think this is really, really cool. To me, this paper just answered so many questions. It's a very enlightening kind of study. Going back, and you know, it's really unfortunate because I don't think that many people know about this work because it's not that sexy, you know, it's not about cortex, it's not about, you know, deep learning, it's just about understanding something in the retina, which a lot of people say is really boring, right? But this is really, really important, you know, because if you don't understand things from the foundations at the very beginning, well, you don't understand anything, right?
Can you say more about this left thing? As if, is there any characteristics, anything that's kind of intuitive or so, which is different from the, let's say, sparse coding?
This?
Yes.
Well, it's not oriented.
It's not
oriented, right? So if you did, you know, this is what we get from sparse coding. Like if you said just be sparse, and you know, give me a small fraction of neurons active for any given image, then this is the kind of solution we get. But as we just said, if you're trying to compress and going down through a bottleneck, it's like not using the balance very often. If we're sparse, right, we're not using all the outcomes equally often. We're not using the energy the neurons can give us to deliver the signal, right? So the hypothesis here is that the retinal ganglion cells and the optic nerve is just trying to deliver. It's just trying to deliver the signal. Not doing anything fancy, not doing fly detection or bird detection or whatever. It's just delivering the signal so the cortex can do something magnificent with it, okay, and figure something out. Okay, but we're trying to get the data through, and that's a really hard job. It's a hard thing to do that with spiking neurons and with high fidelity, right? And to preserve that information.
We see what the threshold for the noises that kind of distinguishes between these two scenarios, like either these simple center solid neurons or these more complex sparse neurons, trying to get an intuitive way of understanding what's going on.
So you said if
these neurons are noisy,
yes,
then the optimal solution is that,
yes,
the one on the left,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So there must be some limit, so to speak, like if there was below a certain level.
He tries different, as you dial in the noise, then it sort of gracefully morphs from this to that. I think there's not something.
What's the information that's transmitted?
Let me be clear. This is in the noisy regime. He's evaluating the system in the noisy regime, right? And it's getting more information through here, okay? And the intuition about that is because this kind of solution, if you could think about this filter, it's not very choosy. These filters are more choosy. Right? They're saying, I'm only going to fire when I see that, right? These are going to fire when it sees just about anything, okay? And if we're firing, you see just about anything, not indiscriminately, it has some way of doing that, then we're doing this. We're filling the space. Okay? If we're being choosy, right, and sparse, then we're not filling the channel. And then we're gonna do a poor job when I put you through a bottleneck. Right? When I cram you through a bottleneck and you're not getting all the answers equally often.
So I think it could also be interesting to look at the white noise gain of the filters you have, because in the center it looks like edge filters very much. Could it be that they're enhancing the noise or the power of the noise too much, so that signal information gets lost under noise that has been amplified?
Yeah, I think maybe there's another way of looking at it, is that by virtue of sort of putting their filters in these directions.
Yeah. I mean, it's really like edge filters, right?
They're like edge filters, right. And so, you know, they're going to be good when that feature occurs, okay, but bad most of the time, right? Most of the rest of the time, right? They're not sharing the load, right, enough. They're kind of being too choosy. Is the way I would. Being choosy is good if you're in the cortex.
Yeah.
But going to high dimensional space, that's a good strategy. We like that, right? Because that makes information explicit. But this is a bad place to do that, is the idea. Yeah.
So this theory produces a whole bunch of retinal ganglion cells with slightly different response properties from one single computational principle. But in the retina, aren't there like 20 or something?
Yes.
Okay. Gene expression and their anatomy.
Of course. Of course. When Marcus Meister gives us talk about the retina, he always bashes efficient coding and Joe Attic and all these things. He says, you know, it's just life is not that simple, right? Because you have all these different types. So first of all, I'm not saying this is a recipe for understanding everything, right? And the question is to see how far can we get with this? It's a hypothesis, right? How much can we explain with something like this? And the other part of it is that if you just consider the parvo cells alone, the parvo projecting, you know, midget retinal ganglion cells, that's like the vast majority of the optic nerve, right? That's just, you swallowed up a big chunk of it. So you put those two, your magnum and parvo, and one thing I'm very interested in doing is seeing if we, I mean, this does a very nice job explaining the on-off split. What about the magnum-parvo split? Can we get that? And I think if you put in temporal bandwidth constraints and metabolic energy there, I think that's going to help us get magnum-parvo, right? When you get to things like direction selectivity, and especially direction selectivity aligned to the, you know, vestibular cell system, okay, no, look, you have to put in other factors to get the whole kit and caboodle out, obviously, yeah. But I think it's really fascinating that just for this part that we can make some headway in understanding it through these statistical, kind of just the statistical ideas, yeah.
I'm kind of struggling with, if I look to W1, it looks like, well, you just represent pixels, which more or less, which on a low level seems like natural, so that you don't have already complicated.
There is a surround here with all of this. This light, that halo there, is very important, right? That's how this computing a difference, right? So that's important. But anyway, yeah, go ahead.
This would improve the resolution to some extent, but.
But it's a generic solution. I think that's the way to look at it. It's very generic.
Like these structures like W2 shows, you would possibly observe on higher levels in your processing.
Yes.
So
it's like when you can afford to be over complete and sparse, then maybe, you know, you do this. But not yet. You know, I think would be. Yeah. Bruchetta question.
Yeah. So maybe back this out to audition. I mean, is this comparison between auditory nerve and optic nerve even a reasonable one to make? Because this is
right.
And if it is, then, you know, the compression issue becomes even more acute. Marcelo was talking about this last week.
Ah.
You know, maybe close to 1,000-fold fewer output channels in the auditory nerve than in the optic nerve.
Yes, so total number of, yeah. Right.
We just address those two points, like, is this really the right, if we want to extrapolate this to auditory nerve behavior, are we even at the right level of computation? It seems like in the optic, the optic nerve has already seen a lot of front-end computation that I'm not sure is present in the auditory nerve.
I guess the way I would sort of think about it is that the input signal in the auditory case is a single scalar. Right? In the visual system, you get this whole array of cones. Okay, so this cones is the starting point, and you have this whole array of them. And now we want to get this whole array of cones down the optic nerve. Okay, in the auditory case, one number, the tympanic membrane's waveform. I think that, to me, is the starting point. The basilar membrane is doing kind of mechanical computation, taking that waveform, breaking it down into different scales, and then that gets transduced and sent out through spiking neurons to so on the face of it, you think, okay, well, you're giving me 30,000 fibers to code one number. That seems like a lot. That doesn't seem to sound like I have a compression problem. But those numbers are not, you know, they don't send voltages. They don't send high fidelity signals, right? Those are spiking neurons that are doing, you know, this kind of thing, right? So now when you, you know, when you put this kind of bottleneck on the system, well, the question is now how many is good enough? And also we have this ginormous dynamic range to encode, both in amplitude and the frequency range too. So I it's a question. I guess I don't know. I don't know the answer if it's appropriate, but I want to know. That's the question I want to sort of answer here. And yeah.
When you say one number, you're like trying to cut everything into pieces temporarily, right? So you say like in the waveform we have just one position in time, but I mean, can you really view it without looking into the temporal context? I mean, in the retina, you can look into a two-dimensional picture you get. So you already have these two dimensions, but here you would have to take time into account. So
absolutely,
it completely changes.
Well, it's one number as a function of time.
Yeah.
I mean, in the image, in this case, it's all these numbers as a function of time as well, right?
But you would have to do the same here, so it's not really one number in that way.
Well, it's one number in the sense, the same sense that a cone is a single number, I guess.
So how do you now relate this figure here to the next one, the left panel you showed in the next
yes.
one? So because now,
retina case,
where you showed the sparse versus the The auditory nerve you showed earlier, so you talked first about sparse coding, and then you showed that probably this is not so attractive because also the auditory nerve firing patterns, they're actually extremely redundant, right? Because you have, if you show it for a given level, you have a lot of information coded at various channels at the same time. So it's extremely redundant, which is very different from what you very started off with. Coming back to redundancy, so how is this related to this left panel? So in the middle is a sparse coding, and then so now we apparently the more attractive solution, so it's not sparse. And what? So how is this now related to this auditory nerve?
So in a sense, in the sparse code, you've removed even more redundancy. Okay. You've converted it into this other form where you had all this higher order redundancy. So the higher redundancy you have here, if you just do this, right?
Yes.
Well, now when in natural scenes you have edges in them. Like when I show you the whitened image of the log, right? You still see the contours, right? So that means that, like, if you have three retinal ganglion cells in a row, that pattern, three in a row, is going to fire quite a bit together. So that's redundant. You haven't removed that, right? The cortex can say, okay, look, I'll do that. Okay, so it will try to code those things. So you're leaving that redundancy here in the retina. Okay, and part of why you're leaving it there is because you need it to protect against noise. You have these limited capacity units, so everybody kind of has to share part of the signal, right? And so you can't afford to, you know, If you were in a fantasy land and you had high precision numbers to work with and lots of them, well, yeah, then you could, right? And so it's an important issue because, you know, in our simulations, we just, like in MATLAB, you work with these numbers that are 8-byte mantissas, and so you have this fantasy that you're on the real number line all the time, you know, and then you can do anything you want. People will invert matrices that have really small singular values and do all things that are nonsense for a real machine. If you're trying to build a machine that does something, these are very important issues to think about.
Yeah. From an auditory point of view, the visual system has an easy task because by the time the image is on the retina, all the spatialization has taken place. And the rest of it is processing spatial images. The auditory system doesn't get even the first try at a spatial image for several stages.
it might be more sensible to look at what the spatial receptive fields are in the auditory system at the first level where they're going to be represented spatially.
I see.
Even if they're not topographic.
I see.
Where is that?
Because in some respects, the first few stages of the auditory system are more like the things in the refractory properties of the lens. They have little delay lines, and they have all kinds of, they do stuff to the sound that's roughly equivalent to what the lens does to the light.
I see. So, right, so you know, the system does all this processing to pull out, you know, two dimensions, a spatial representation of what was starting as just two scalar signals. One can make the same argument in the visual system, right? We get this two-dimensional array,
yeah,
and the visual system beautifully pulls out third dimension,
sure,
right? Very strongly so, right? And so you know, I could one-up you on that argument, right? And say the visual system is going to...
Because the two systems actually are symmetric, because the visual system uses stereo to get depth, and the auditory system uses stereo to get horizontal. So the weirdness is the auditory system's failure to have a third ear in the cortex.
Okay. Well, I guess the point is, you know, so we could always, so we could start at the spatial representation in the auditory system, but then, but so that just sort of pushes us back. I mean, what about, you know, the cochlea? I mean, the auditory nerve. Why is, we still have to answer that, right? At what, you know, what, why are we doing that?
That just might be what it is efficiently coding, even if it is.
That I see.
Is just not the same thing.
Or it might be that you want to think about how it's going to take that and spatial. Extract space from it as part of the coding criterion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, I'm interested in this idea that noise tolerance, or how much noise there is in the system, governs whether you're going to go into sparse coding mode and get kind of blue RFs, or whether you're going to be in a dense mode and get red RFs. So, on a single cell level, we have a good understanding of the single cell properties that correlate with noise robustness, right? You know, if you want to increase the firing capacity of your cell, make your spikes thinner, and that's very expensive because you increase the light between sodium and potassium.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to make your spikes kind of more reliable so that there's no failures, you get them when you want them, then you increase the sodium channel density in the cell, which makes your spikes taller, but it makes them very, very reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there is something here that we should be able to calculate what the spikes should be shaped like,
uh-huh,
or maybe reverse engineer what the spikes should be shaped like by
yes,
looking at.
Totally, I love that. Yeah. I think so. Putting more biophysics into it about the factors that go into creating the spike in the to begin with.
Spike shapes vary between species very much? Or do they systematically vary between retinal ganglion cell populations that have, you know, RFs that look more one way or more another way?
So one of my fantasies actually is to get spikes to emerge as a coding idea alone. So start with an analog neuron that can sort of code greater signals and then show that it chooses to spike because that's more metabolically efficient or something. I mean, all these companies right now are really interested in neuromorphic engineering. Qualcomm launched a whole division a number of years ago to do neuromorphic computing, and then they have spikes on the brain. Like, they think spikes are so important, and they really want to make it work. And I think they, obviously they are, and we know the biology uses that idea, but I still think even in neuroscience, we don't really understand why. You know, we have intuitions about why, we have verbal explanations about why, but actually, but show it, you know? If it's true, we should be able, that should emerge as the most efficient solution in a biophysically constrained simulation and different spike shapes and stuff like that. That'd be awesome, yeah. I have a feeling that where time is it?
We have kind of an overtime, but on the other hand, we are still 10 minutes away from cookies, so we...
Yeah, just go.
We have more
cookies.
Time to...
I'll give you 10 minutes of entertainment. 5 minutes of entertainment before I put cookies, okay? So, I won't talk about that. So, I just wanted to talk about this problem of perception as an inference problem. So this is going, maybe think about things that the cortex is doing. I'll be very brief about this, but... So if we sort of think about, you know, going into the problems of, you know, vision or audition or touch or any of these other modalities, and what are we trying to do? It seems like this idea of thinking about it as an inference problem is really key. All right. So this is an example of inference in the visual system. Okay. So how many of you see what's in this image? How many can see the figure? Nobody's seen this before? Okay. Good. So this is where, yeah, right. So there's a so if you give this to people like yourselves who've not seen this before, and you ask them to draw what they see, this is what the subject draws. Is this what you would draw? Kind of, more or less. Okay. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you what's in here. It's a cow. And this is the head of the cow.
Oh, yeah.
This is the snout, the eyes. This is like the body going up here.
Still don't see it.
Still don't see it?
Eyes.
Okay.
So I see one eye.
Nose is down.
Ah, it's a snout.
It. Yes, okay.
Head.
Nice.
I'm trying to not see it.
Okay, so now you see the cow. So now you ask the subject who sees the cow, draw what you see. And this is the joke. Okay, so where'd this come from? This is the data. This is the data in the image. This is the data on your retina. And this is not data. This is like from the world. This is your brain. This is a story inside your brain that your brain created about what it thinks it sees here. And you know, the subject drew all kinds of edges here. I mean, like, it drew this edge. That doesn't exist at all in this image, right? It put another eye over here. There's no eye over there, right? So it does all, you know, subject is putting all kinds of things, hallucinating an ear out here where there should be something in the scene. So this is like, you know, we can come up with lots of examples like this, Dalmatian dog and tons of examples and auditory equivalents of these. But what they teach us is about, you know, the importance of top-down priors, information processing, that we're forming a story of this data, that we're getting very sparse signals from the world. And moreover, but I think the important thing to keep in mind is that this is not simply like some little toy lab demonstration. You're doing this all the time. You're doing it right now, right? Everything you see is this kind of thing happening. Because if you looked at the raw data in the retina, if you looked at like a raw retinal image, you'd be terrified, right? Just like the noisiness of the information there, the incompleteness of it, the cones are interdigitated, it's moving all the time, okay? Even in the fovea, you have these motions all the time. So it's an unstable image. Retinal images look nothing like your perception. Your perception is completely going way beyond the data, right? Creating like this story about it, which is very compelling, very clean, very crisp, which it does not, it's not the raw data. So you don't experience this, you experience that. And so...
You experience both.
Well, okay, yeah, right, okay. That's right, you can sort of veto that as if you can try.
Is that related to the FedEx logo? Because I know that's another classic example.
Uh-huh.
Is that like the same basic thing?
Like a sort of a...
your attention to it?
I mean, because there's like an occluding contour there, I mean, it looks like in the...
Oh, that's like... I mean, like with the arrow in it? Because most people don't see it.
I see.
You point it out, everybody's like, that's all they see.
I see.
I don't know if that relates...
I don't know.
Have you ever seen that example?
Yeah, I think, yeah.
Because most people, once you know it,
I see. Then you always see the arrow.
So I didn't know if this is intention.
Once you see this, you'll always see the cow. If I do this next year, then we'll. Yeah.
Did you ask people to draw like?
I didn't do this. This is someone else's. Yeah.
Or somebody.
Yeah.
Whoever asked them, did they say draw lines like something that can be, you know, closed loops rather than, you know, I'd imagine if you asked some other kind of artist to draw it, they'd say, okay, this bit will be shaded. It might
maybe
the
shady.
A bit different,
yeah.
You know?
Right.
I don't know.
Sorry, try to get the speckle. I don't. That's a good question, but I don't know exactly what the instructions were. But the other remarkable thing about this, beyond that, along those lines, is that you know, you. But at the same time, you see this as a cow. You know, all this sort of graininess gets explained away as something else. You're saying, well, that's not the cow. That's something in the photographic plate or some other process, right? You didn't know that before, right? Before it might have been all flat. Or this kind of thing up here, you might sort of say, well, that must be a crack in the image that's not on the cow, right? So it gets explained away as something else. So there's a richness to the story that you're creating here, right? You're pulling out all kinds of detail that it goes way beyond just the raw data. And so, you know, if we look in the cortex, we see all these top-down feedback connections. There's information going both directions. And so, like, what's that doing, right? And it's remarkable to me that to this day in the vision science community, a lot of people sort of think that the feedback connections just aren't that important and not doing much, and you can still do vision kind of just with feedforward connections. And I think it's just really a very important kind of thing to include in our thinking. And
That's amazing. You should try working in Audition.
Oh yeah. Okay. Fine. Right. So here's like David Marr's diagrams of, you know, the processing. You start with the image. You go to edges. and everything is going from this to this to this. There's this logical chain, right? And even though I don't believe in the story, I almost can't get it out of my head. Because as I sort of grew up with this idea, and you know, the arrows have to go in both directions, right? I mean, this level informs that level, this form of, because you can't extract these things purely bottom up. It's too ambiguous. There's too many ambiguities. This is Dick Lyon's picture. Dick Lyon's, okay, he has the feedback connection. So, but he says they're optional. So at one point I would disagree is that these are not optional, right? This is just, this has to be a part of how you think about it. It has to be totally integrated into it. You can't sort of divorce it out. Okay, deep learning, of course, you know, totally ignores that, right? And I think the thing that's wrong with this model, I mean, a lot of people now, it's very popular to sort of look at these models and then relate properties of these models to the cortex. And so, oh yeah, this is like the brain, whatever. So it's not just that it's anatomically wrong, it's not just that there's no feedback connections, but think about the problem, the way they're framing the problem. They're framing it as an input-output problem. You put the image in here, and you output the class. And that's it. That's perception. Right? But that's, you know, so you could train this on that cow image, you put the cow and then it says cow, out. But that's doesn't nearly capture what's happening, right? And so it's a very rich thing that's happening. You can't just sort of frame it as an input-output.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
an audition as well.
There's something blurred here.
Okay.
So if you take information theory and you just ask, so I have some input, and how do I get the optimal output for some task, for example, classification?
Yeah.
Then certainly information theory tells you to use Bayes' decision rule. But then certainly the question is, how do I model everything which is in between? But it does tell you there's ideally no intermediate decisions or anything like that. So even if you train such a network, which you have shown, it will implicitly include, so the optimal result you can show under very little assumptions of such a network will be the true probability distribution, will be based, so following Bayes' rule. So it will even include like prior information implicitly. So I would not say this is like ignoring
I think it's dumbing down perception.
Sorry?
It's dumbing down perception, right? This is not the right. This is something we can do.
What you have shown on the slide before,
yeah.
This
yeah.
Where you said the arrows also have to go backwards.
Yes.
This one was the one before.
Yes.
I mean, that's what's done in like speech recognition systems.
I know.
So,
yes.
It works, it does things. You collect all, no, what I have to say is
yeah.
You have both variables. You collect all information before you do the decision. So it's not like you do this.
Okay. So I think I see what you're saying. You're saying like, so maybe we're getting a very rich representation, some like here, and then I do classification, but maybe I'm getting a very rich perceptual representation here prior to that.
I mean, certainly you have to, I mean, at some point, because of the complexity of the problem, you have to reduce complexity at some point. So you cannot like have to hypothesize all the world before you do a decision. I would argue kind of using these models would be a limitation in that way, because I mean, if I, for example, apply these models on speech, I usually use nowadays recurrent models. So before I do a decision, I've seen the whole utterance, the whole context, all information available. I trained into the system all the prior information. So where's the bottleneck or where's the shortcoming? I don't see that.
Well, let me finish. Okay, it's a great question. I mean, I'm just saying I don't think so. This is at least in the vision community, this is how people pose the vision problem, and you know, it's like, well, okay, fine. It's not just one object. I'll take a scene like this and I'll draw boxes around things and label them, right? And even that, I'm just saying that's not perception, because when you look at this scene, like you know, like Fei-Fei Li sees, you could practically write a novel about what you see here, right? The level of just the detail, and so if we sort of treat this about this is the end goal, that's not. We have this very rich space inside of our heads. And so I just want to sort of focus on this diagram here. So this is basically taking the Van Essen-Fellman diagram. One could probably make a similar diagram for auditory cortex, I'm sure. Taking the Van Essen-Fellman diagram where there's boxes stacked vertically, but there's drawing the boxes according to area, square millimeters of cortex, occupied by those different areas, right? So this is like V1, this is V2. These are ginormous amounts of cortex being devoted to this, right? And then here might be like the top box up here. This is like the objects and faces and things like that, right? And so I think the question is like, well, where's perception in this? It's like, you know, is perception here? In the top box, and I guess what I wanted to argue is this really in all these levels. It's a highly distributed thing that lives. It lives down here. It lives down here. It lives at different levels. And as well, the important thing is that all these different levels of cortex have outputs, have motor outputs. Essentially, this is something that Murray Sherman and Ray Guillory argue for, just looking at the thalamocortical loop. So all these areas are interconnected in a loop with thalamus, and the pulvinar, the visual thalamus, the pulvinar. And the pulvinar sort of recapitulates this organization. So there's the part of pulvinar that interconnects with V1 and V2, another part that interconnects with these areas, another part that interconnects with these areas, right? So what they argue is that all of these areas have motor outputs. Essentially, like V1 projects to supraculiculus, for example, and directs eye movements. It has something to say about that. And when it does, it makes a copy, an efferent copy to thalamus, and that's related back to cortex. So maybe the right way to think about this is a sensory motor loop, and all levels of this hierarchy have something to say about actions. And so this is just one way I'm trying to think about the system more, because I grew up with that Venison-Fellman diagram. I can't get out of my head. You know, you start with the image, you go to the top box, you go to decision, motor output, and you know, no, that's not right, but what do we replace it with? And so here's maybe a sort of another way of sort of looking at this. You have sensors, you have actuators. Actuators act through the physics of the world to change sensory information, so you have the sensory motor loop. And what the system is not trying to do is just kind of learn reflexive actions. It's not like you're just trying to convert images into actions, but you really need to form some representation of state. You want to form some kind of internal model of the world, and that's going to help inform your actions. And this internal model needs to be built up from multiple images, from multiple auditory, from all this auditory data as you move through the world, that you're assimilating this together, the state or the internal representation that that guides action. Okay, so anyways, I think I'll just there's more to say, but I'll just kind of leave it there. But it just I think this is an open question of how to do this, and Bayes' rule is the answer to all this. to estimate this internal state, but it's and so I think one thing we're really trying to pursue is trying to flesh out these Bayesian inference models using hierarchical Bayesian inference. I'll just point to this nice paper by Lee and Mumford, where they're sort of trying to take this idea of Bayesian inference and sort of flesh it out in a more detailed way of how could it work throughout the visual cortex. And I think you can map the same story onto auditory cortex. Oh, okay. More and more to say. I know where you want to go. But there's this really nice work by Don Karklin and Eero Simoncelli, where they started to do this for auditory representations. You start with like this is the spike gram representation down here, the low level kind of code. And this is like a second layer representation that's trying to extract higher order structure out of the sound. And the cool thing about this, because it's a generative model, is now you get feedback on the game. So as these higher order units see patterns, then they go back to lower levels and change the processing down here at lower levels. That's sort of built into Bayesian inference. That's part of how it works. And so this, I think, would go a long way towards speech intelligibility, filling in with noise. These kinds of models are going to have that property of filling in and being, or seeing the cow and things like that. Is this is the structure that maps naturally onto those problems, and that to me is the future for cortical models.
Do you have specific predictions of the level of the neural signals that we can measure in the auditory system, for example? So you can go and say, hey, this explains this variability or this.
So for feedback, right? I mean, one example there is that people have really tried to sort of get at this question for a long time by cooling a higher level area and then looking at how it changes processing in a lower level area, right? There's lots of studies like this, and the results are kind of all over the map. There's a zoo of very, not very convincing results that it does anything, right? The problem is that almost all those studies are using things like gratings, spots, noise, and so forth, the stimuli, right? So they're sort of asking, well, how does it change the orientation tuning curve of that neuron, right? Well, if you want to see the effect of these feedback connections, you have to sort of put the system in a regime where it's doing inference, okay? If you just show a sine wave grating, there's not much to infer there for the system, right? You're not sort of engaging it to do something. And so I think a really crucial thing that would fall out of these models is that is that if you want to see the effects of feedback, let's, you know, give it natural scenes, give it natural sounds, give it some ambiguity that it has to resolve. Watch it resolve it and see, and then that would be the prediction. That's where you're going to see something happen.
Right. But what, I mean, I need to read this, thank you, but what has been done to evaluate, also to verify this model? So what has been, which predictions have been achieved here to predict what kind of outcome measure?
It's early days. What I'm giving you is a very blurry proposal.
Yeah, okay, so
I would take Jan Karklin's model. I think he was on the right track. I would take this model. I would start fixing it up in various ways.
Okay.
But I think, you know, if
it's not a quantitative model that makes actual predictions.
It will be. I will be. This is my grant proposal to you, right? So I'm going to fix this model up, and you know, it's a good starting point. But I'm going to have a model that does amazing things. It's going to like improve speech intelligibility by filling in here. It's going to have very powerful feedback down here that does this stuff. And it's going to be sort of a neural framework and specific enough that we can have phenomena here that now we can look at and say, okay, here, think of this as like an A1 neuron. This is what I would expect it to be doing, right? And this is the kind of thing we should look for. We don't have that yet because, you know, it has to be sort of like working and sort of fleshed out, detailed enough. But that's where we want. That's where we want to go.
I should add, so I gave a talk earlier in the program, like a few weeks ago, about some work that I've been doing recently concerning responses in the brain stem for attention to one or two speakers, and for the first time kind of using running speech, that kind of a natural stimulus, and you see a very clear modulation of that activity in the brain stem that is most, I mean, obviously driven by feedback from higher cortical areas. And so I think we think also that it can be quite powerful, or can certainly contribute to cleaning up speech or to listening in situations with competing speakers. So I'm also very interested in that. I'll check that out.
Could you go back to one of the slides where you have these interconnections? One of the last slides, I think it was.
Yeah,
this
the
this
that,
one, yes.
Yeah.
So if I, for example, for speech recognition, you build an acoustic model using recurrent neural networks, which are bidirectional, which look into a complete temporal context, and you stack them on top of each other, so you have all this interaction, or do I oversee something here? So you go, you have several layers.
Yeah.
You don't have the recurrency going from top to bottom.
We want it to go top. So we don't just want it going sideways, you want it going from higher levels down to lower levels.
You only have the temporal.
I mean, one could do that in a deep network. I mean, you could sort of put down feedback connections, now train it end to end. And maybe it does. I would be depressed if it, you know, I just don't know. Again, because the task is just, it's just too simple-minded a task. I mean, I think we need to sort of tax it with something richer. It's like a behaving system that actually has to do more than just label things. It has to sort of get three-dimensional information, act on it, build a model with it, and things like that.
What is your lockout argument against, let's say, deep neural networks, where I've learned the last weeks that they can essentially everything and can put in everything based on multiple data, and also we learn these connections and everything. Now you are showing an alternative approach, but what is the argument against, so to speak, let's say, deep neural networks that can otherwise are so powerful? So what can they not do, which is provided in this framework?
Well, there's the can-do part, and then there's the understanding part.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in the understanding part.
Right.
So this diagram is not too unlike a deep mind network, right? I mean, every time I bring up some of my students, I give them some objection, and they give me a counterexample. Well, deep mind just did this last week. See, they have this everything. So maybe you could. They probably have a system like this that plays some video game and has an internal state, and you know, does some actions and does some cool things, and it works. So that's impressive, but now what we have to do is take that deep mind system, we have to do physiology on it, right, and try to understand it. So maybe the argument is, well, that's accessible, now we can get every neuron if we want, but I think there's a better way. I really do. I don't think that's, this end-to-end approach is just, I think there's a better way we can sort of, well, maybe both ways. I mean, I think maybe it could teach us something, but it's not the only way, right? We can come at it from a different angle, yeah.
I mean, for example, having a prior probability on the top, you get at least some interaction, not as detailed as possibly you're thinking, but So if I have an acoustic model, it doesn't model at that time what's like the prior distribution of some.
It doesn't give out specific
sequence of words. But by keeping hypotheses before you actually fill in that information, you actually make sure that you end up with allowing for that.
Perfect. That's right.
That's like the usual way, even without neural networks, in former times.
That's what I guess what I'm arguing for is.
Maybe as a remark, from a signal processing point of view, I think that's what we have to do for signal enhancement, for example. We go from sensory data, microphones, to object recognition, whatever, and then we recognize an object. But in order to perform signal enhancement, we really have to go back to the sensor level and produce better sounding signals that you can transmit via a loudspeaker or via a hearing aid or something. Right? So there we, in the ultimate goal, I would say there we really want to transcend these hierarchies in the up direction, make a decision, yes, but this is what you want to improve, enhance, and then go all the way back to the time domain signal in order to get the better signal out and present to the user. So that's very implied in a way. Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, I think so. Absolutely.
Can you go back to your grant proposal to Torsten?
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. I think that was that's John's model. Yeah.
So just a general question. So your point about the Bialikian point of view about searching for principles is very good one. But how do you reconcile something that's relatively heuristic like this? Intemperate with kind of just basic biophysical constraints of what the cochlea has to do. Like.
Well, I don't think it is heuristic. I mean, this may look heuristic, but the point is it's all learned, right? All these things that are sort of going on here. You just sort of came in with a fairly generative model. Is that what you mean by the heuristic part?
I guess I didn't mean heuristic so much in the sense that the ideas going on here, because that could be real and whatnot.
Yes.
I guess I just meant necessarily maybe constraints that kind of feed into what the model like from the front end.
So that's, I guess, the full story is like that's the. We talked about all this stuff about the coding, the efficient coding and the cochlea and things about things, coming up with the right model there. I mean, to me, like that's step one, right, is getting a good foundation to build these models on and something that you can, that respects the biophysical constraints and it is, and then working up from there. So when I said sort of fix it, that's one part I want to fix, is coming up with the right front-end model that one can use into the system. But beyond just coding, once I delivered the information, I've coded it, I delivered to the brain, now what do I want to do with it, right? And now what I say is, well, we want to infer. We want to infer things about the world from this data, and now let's solve an inference problem and try to build up an internal representation of the world from the sensory data. And that would be...
Yeah, that sounds right. I guess maybe I pitched it the wrong way, I guess it's more of a sense of kind of guidance, like, how would you kind of suggest to avoid having good models that are too heuristic and then you realize downstream, like, hey, wait a second, I didn't place enough kind of real physical constraints and I ended up somewhere that's interesting, but it's not necessarily relevant.
Well, I guess, to me, the two guiding lampposts are, you know, anatomy and physiology on one end, but also behavior on the other. So that, you know, like neuroethologies, like what do animals actually do with their system? And that helps you ask the right question. I think that's where one place where the computer scientists have kind of gone awry is because they've come up with these challenge benchmark tasks that they kind of invented overnight, and then they spend like years solving them. And I think like coming up with that right problem, the right challenge problem that really forces you into the kind of landscape that a brain is solving is a non-trivial problem. Just coming up with a problem definition, like what's the benchmark task? What should the system do? It's not actually obvious. And so I think that's what we're going to get from the behavior end. And that's going to help the other guiding other guidance. Yeah.
I would say we train our image progression now on looking for cookies. But thank you very much again for a fascinating talk.